Chaos in government always inevitably ends in one of two ways. An established government will put its foot down and squash rebellion, or the rebellion occurs, and all of a sudden, the rebels will start experiencing growing pains. From there, the rebels will either get it together, or there will be a background figure lurking, watching, and waiting to make a move. Napoleon had been the latter during his search for power. He had enough confidence to be dangerous. That's why he pulled it off. He had enough supporters to merge and mold things the way he wanted. There were naysayers, but then something unbelievable began to occur. Napoleon was actually good at the job. He ruled hard and totally, and some likely assumed that if it weren't taking place during a battle, Napoleon wouldn't know what steps to take next. But as he ruled as first consul, he began leading and designing legislation that made sense to the point that some of it is still incorporated into legislation in France today. However, when some concerns were raised by politicians who would point out that they had just overthrown a monarchy and that they appeared to be headed back that way, when asked, "What of the revolution?" Napoleon would simply say, "I am the revolution." This is God's Favorites, a history podcast. Napoleon Bonaparte, Episode 5. I am not the world's biggest Maximilien Robespierre fan. I think the former revolutionary leader was hypocritical, deranged, and Robespierre went from being correct about the tyranny of the monarchy to becoming a tyrant himself. But the way he must have nearly sat up, headless, in his grave when Napoleon declared himself emperor. Not only that, he began incorporating a line of succession so that his heirs could take his spot. Revolutionaries had to have been aghast. We did all this work for what? For what? A complete 180-degree turn and a line of succession. For me, though, it never made sense. Napoleon had ambition, but his success had always been based on the fact that he hired the best people, as opposed to surrounding himself with people who had earned their station through their birth. And yet that power made him just delusional enough to run with it. In less than a decade, France is going to go from one absolute leader to another. Though Napoleon stressed the importance of keeping the clergy out of France's education system, he allowed Catholicism to be the main religion of France and slowly allowed the church to retain some of its lost property. The clergy had also been targeted during the French Revolution and had its riches seized. When people pointed out the hypocrisy of his actions, Napoleon spoke like a true statesman. "When I'm in France, I'm Catholic. When I was in Egypt, I was a Mohammedan." That quote always hit home for me, just how much of a chameleon that Napoleon was. He would fit some shapes just to appease crowds to get what he wanted. But Napoleon's Code Civil still exists in many ways. There have been multiple revisions since its inception, but if you don't like Napoleon on principle, you're not going to like how much most of his rules make sense. Prior to the Revolution, laws in France changed by region, meaning you could be ruled by one set of laws in the south of France, and if you headed north, you'd change to a new set of laws. Napoleonic Code sought to rule France under one set of laws for all. At the end of its codification, all citizens were considered equal. There was a separation of church and state, though it was a code of its time, making women subservient in their homes. And though allowing divorce, it often ruled in favor of the men when it came to possessions and children. The code was disseminated into French-held territories and inspired others. Versions are still used in Belgium and Luxembourg. And if you thought the United States of America had escaped the influence of Napoleon Bonaparte, I'm sorry to tell you that the state of Louisiana, a civil law state versus a common law state, took the vast majority of its tenets from the Napoleonic Code. He made it to the U.S., baby. Oh, and of course, speaking on the U.S. and Louisiana, coincidentally, Thomas Jefferson is working on actively living his best life. This is after the death of Alexander Hamilton, which probably aided in his good mood. But Jefferson is dreaming of land expansion, and it's going to be hard to do when a good majority of the land is still owned by the French and Spanish. It's around 1802 that Thomas Jefferson starts dropping hints in his letters, like a child trying to obtain a toy on the shelves without explicitly asking for it. He writes to ministers and points out how badly they'd like to have Louisiana, and how not having the land there is greatly affecting him. The land had been passed between the French and Spanish, but the Spanish had at least allowed Americans access. Once France got their ports back, they blocked out the Americans, and thus Jefferson realized his struggles were going to force him to make a move. And did I mention that Thomas Jefferson hated Napoleon? Diplomacy was tried first, but it was a slower process than Jefferson liked. It's 1803. France's strongholds in the New World were always dependent on their situation in Saint-Domingue, present-day Haiti. Napoleon's resources are going to be spread too thin. If you want my opinion, I feel like this is always his biggest fault in terms of governing. There were wars brewing, and France would have to fund another humbling of the British at some point. So Napoleon decides to accept Jefferson's persistent request, and eventually, he sells the Louisiana Territory to the United States for $15 million. That's 4 cents an acre. For the rest of his life, Thomas Jefferson is going to laud this as one of, if not the most successful move of his career. And yes, I suppose it is partly due to his diplomacy, but in reality, it is more to be attributed to an upcoming war with Britain and a group of Haitians who are about to humble Napoleon in ways he never thought were possible. Libre Haiti! Let's go! It's time for the Haitian Revolution. Haiti is a beautiful country wrecked by economic hardships, foreign meddling, no infrastructure, and corruption. It is also a country that shows the world the dangerous effects and repercussions of colonialism. Haiti has been called a few things in its life: Hispaniola by the Spanish, who landed there in the late 15th century, terrorizing and killing its indigenous population. Christopher Columbus and crew will never be covered on this podcast because I refuse to say that man was God's favorite, even ironically. When even Ferdinand and Isabel, two notoriously brutal leaders, are like, "Yo, Chris, chill. You know this guy is evil." Then the French took over, slowly choking out the Spanish and bringing with them enslaved people. Haiti would become Saint-Domingue and become a hub for the export of sugarcane. Harvesting sugarcane is backbreaking labor. You are cutting, bent over in the heat of the equator. The island also produced cotton and indigo, and in a year, the country would produce roughly 70 million pounds of raw sugar. As for social caste, it is worth noting that not all individuals of African descent in Haiti were enslaved. But what will happen in the aftermath of the French Revolution in the 1790s will be a team-up of all these social groups against the French. Many of the Haitians saw the French Revolution as a sign of incoming freedom, but eventually they would see that that whole égalité part didn't really apply to them in the eyes of the French. It's in 1791 that a slave rebellion takes place. Under the cover of a thunderstorm, slaves killed their masters and fought against oppression, briefly holding the entire northern part of the colony. This was an event of great magnitude that shocked France. And yet, in the midst of the violence, not once did the Haitians ask to actually just be liberated. They just asked France to prohibit slavery. That option was not interesting to anyone in the French government, as Haiti remained France's cash cow. Free labor made a profit. A significant profit. The country will teeter-totter its stance on slavery multiple times, but in the midst of this, there is a man who will humble Napoleon Bonaparte quite a bit. You're going to love him, and he deserves his own God's favorite series. Toussaint Louverture is a free man who is going to be one of the catalysts for France's departure off the island and really out of this side of the world. Louverture is complicated, a free man in Haiti who would eventually own slaves himself. He had also been born on a plantation, and for the most part, he would express that he wanted France to be a part of Haiti's future, but with more of a civil partnership between them and the Haitians. You could also kind of describe him as a moderate, and moderates make dangerous targets. When a moderate person is taken out of a situation by politicians hungry for power or revenge, it usually always backfires. The example that comes to mind is the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He was less stringent than his uncle on certain topics, and they didn't really like one another. But when Ferdinand met his end by a nationalist bullet, it caused an uproar that led to a war, the likes of which no one had ever seen before. That exact same thing is going to happen here. In another universe, Louverture could have had the same training and success that Napoleon Bonaparte did. But even in a universe where he had to fight for every single win, he excelled. He shined as an equestrian and took care of the horses on the plantation he was born, where he received an education and was manumitted sometime in the 1770s, earning his freedom. His appetite for women was also as large as Napoleon's. He would be married twice, and some sources report him as having up to 16 children by several different women. That certainly indicates that he was definitely more talented than Napoleon in that regard, as he and Josephine were still struggling to produce an heir. A member of the class, Jean de Couleuribre, Toussaint was walking in a strange world, somewhere between the free Frenchmen who weren't rich and those of the others on the island who were enslaved persons or indigenous. Every time I've spoken to a Haitian about Louverture, they do acknowledge that he was making a fortune using the same system that the French were. And by that, I mean he went back to oversee the plantation he worked on, which understandably leaves a bad taste in some of their mouths. But in many ways, Louverture served as an inside champion, working and negotiating between enslaved persons and plantation owners. He began negotiating against the use of whips and corporal punishment, which seems bare minimum, and he also asked for one extra day off a week. After the white governor of Haiti refuses this offer, Toussaint confused his cohorts by refusing to allow them to execute the white prisoners they had taken in these raids and rebellions. Instead, Toussaint Louverture decided to kickstart an alliance that is going to raise the ire of Napoleon. Toussaint and his fellow revolutionaries are going to try to align with the Spanish, and the Spanish are going to let them learn how to fight like soldiers. Louverture, like Napoleon in another universe, would have been a general. The man could fight, and he had an added advantage of knowing the landscape in Haiti, as well as an education from the Spanish, though he will also later turn on them. He also had a natural instinct to recruit and surround himself with talented men and to attempt to ally with countries who didn't like France. Louverture is going to use his men to eliminate every rival in his path until he can take over the island with the French still on it. Louverture is going to enforce laws that will force enslaved persons back to work only with improved conditions. And he's also going to look for reconciliation over revenge and extend olive branches to the French and Spanish and others. And much like Napoleon, he's going to be very picky with whom he trades. He begins trading sugar with the United States at a pretty decent price, too, and Napoleon is getting angrier by the minute with this so-called new governor of Haiti. Napoleon's prejudices blinded him to the skill that Louverture clearly had, and he just wanted Haiti back. Louverture insisted that Haiti was being loyal to the Republic of France. All the while, he drilled his men on military practices. It's like he knew what was coming. In 1802, Napoleon's brother-in-law, Charles Leclerc, is going to invade Haiti with a force that no one expected. But Louverture tells him they will welcome him without bloodshed if he doesn't restore slavery. Toussaint is actually assured of this, and then he's invited to a meeting with a French general to discuss Haiti's future. It was a trap. Toussaint was abducted and taken to France, where he would slowly die of illness. He had never even left Haiti before that moment. In another universe, Toussaint Louverture would have been the leader of a country. He would have been revered and respected by those around him, and history would talk about him and his accomplishments. But in this universe, he died in a cold prison because he had been born on a plantation. But if Napoleon thought getting rid of him was going to be the end of his troubles in Haiti, he didn't understand the impact he had caused by martyring Toussaint Louverture. Louverture had people who respected him. His lieutenants, including Jean-Jacques Dessalines, are going to continue the fight. Leclerc is going to get his, don't worry. Leclerc, who is married to Bonaparte's sister Pauline, will fall ill in the midst of his revenge tour on the Haitians. A man who likely thought he was going to die a hero would meet his death like many Frenchmen. Leclerc would die on the receiving end of a mosquito bite. Yellow fever did its part in the Haitian war effort, more so than the Haitians, actually. Pauline would return to Europe. Rochambeau, of American independence fame, would come back to replace Leclerc, but it's no use. Dessalines and its men joined forces and ran the French out of Haiti. The first successful slave rebellion that freed an entire country. In 1804, the Haitians would execute a good majority of the French on the island as a bit of a warning, a little late for a warning, but nevertheless, to stay out. They returned to the Arawak name for the island, Haiti. But France would extort Haiti for repayments for restitution. If the money was not paid, they would return. That was always the threat. So France found another way to drain Haiti dry. And though France has not collected a payment from Haiti in ages, some of that debt was sold to the United States, and France makes indemnity on that money to this day. So even though the Haitians won, France found another way to exploit them. Napoleon has about a 10-minute bounce-back period before he is on to his next pain-in-the-ass move. His sister Pauline, widowed, is back, and Napoleon and Josephine are working hard to conceive an heir. He's becoming despondent about this whole thing, as is Joe. In the meantime, and around the same time that Haiti and France are going at it, Napoleon has managed to find some peace. The Treaty of Amiens in 1802 will provide about 14 months of quiet between the French, Spanish, Dutch, and the British. The treaty opened up some past trade routes and restored some property, and thus, things probably felt quite good in France at this moment. This will not last. The treaty will collapse when Britain decides to declare war on France in 1803, and despite this, Napoleon has decided it's time to establish himself as strongly as possible as a leader. He toys with an invasion of England. Even reading books about Julius Caesar, and he puts up the Bayeux Tapestry, which depicts the Norman conquest of England in the Louvre, and he has a coin designed in that style featuring a nearly naked image of himself invading England, and he unironically began referring to England as Carthage. Subtlety was never Napoleon's thing. But for all the jokes about Napoleon being small and the French surrendering, I don't think some people realize the strength that Napoleon had and how truly difficult he was to defeat. Brace yourselves. I'm about to make a sports analogy. If you aren't an American, it's March. And March is a time that we all call March Madness, in which university basketball teams compete in the NCAA tournament. University sports have a cult-like following here. And in the United States, there are certain schools that have dynastic programs, meaning that even when they are weak, their reputation keeps their fans going and supportive. I attended the University of Kentucky, which is one of those programs. You also have Duke University, the University of North Carolina, University of California in Los Angeles. When the history is so rich that even when you, go out in the first round of the tournament against Oakland, your fans may be angry, but when you have such a storied history, they'll forgive a lot. Now, I am not comparing Napoleon to John Calipari, head coach of Kentucky men's basketball. All I'm saying is a lot is forgiven when you have won a lot previously, and it is going to take 7 coalitions to bring Napoleon down. Meanwhile, Napoleon's marriage is not hunky-dory.
In 1804, he has two mistresses. One is an actress, and another is known only by an initial, appropriately, at least in English, the letter F.
Meanwhile, Josephine is not enjoying the shift in dynamics because she writes a letter to Napoleon, who has to assure her that no one will be able to replace her in his heart. But matters of state soon pull everyone's focus when a British plot to assassinate Napoleon is uncovered. The Brits were working with the Duke of the Bourbon line, but he was in Germany, and as such, Napoleon sends his cohorts to kidnap the Duke and bring him to neutral soil where he is killed, causing those who still consider themselves aristocracy to be shocked and frightened. But in many ways, the pushback from the aristocratic line was Napoleon's gateway to bigger things. They wanted to undo the results of the revolution. They thought their lines were superior. That meant the entire republic was in danger and that he, as the leader of this republic, needed a title more befitting his station, an irreplaceable nature. Emperor. This was met with mixed results, and those who wanted to fight back against him were threatened. On May 10th, Napoleon was named emperor officially in a 15-minute ceremony, and he immediately placed his brothers in roles. Well, not all of his brothers. At that time, he was fighting with his brothers Louis and Jerome. He added his other brothers, though, to the line of succession should he and his wife unhappily be unable to conceive a child. Attempts to get the Pope to dissolve the marriage had been refused, much to his chagrin. Josephine and Napoleon appeared to be stuck with one another. In fact, Pius refused to participate in the coronation of the emperor until he and Joe remarried with Catholic rites. And Napoleon acquiesced, because there was a party to plan. The Imperial Council met at St. Cloud and began working to pick a spot. The coronations of kings of yore had been in Reims, but they wanted a new spot, a new branding. Thus, the coronation was set for the 2nd of December, 1804, at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Painter Jacques-Louis David will paint the coronation, and it remains one of his most famous works. His painting shows what kind of opulence anyone would have seen that day. Rich velvet-draped robes with jewels and throngs of important people. The emperor and empress entered the cathedral at 11:45 that morning to singing. It was full of ceremony, though some reports say Napoleon did appear to be bored at some points and stifled a yawn on occasion, but at the moment, he was to be crowned. The story goes that Napoleon grabbed the crown from Pius's hands and placed it on his head. That had to be shocking. His reasoning is uncertain. It could be a power play to let the Pope know that he was in charge, not the Vatican. It could be that he was just awkward and didn't know what to do with his hands, but here's what I think. When he placed that crown upon his head with his own hands, I think Napoleon revealed what he truly thought of himself. At 35 years old, now emperor, I think Napoleon Bonaparte thought he was God. But soon he's going to find out, very, very quickly, that he is just as mortal as the rest of us. God's Favorites is a semi-weekly podcast, although we did go bi-weekly this time around. Hey, how nice! All right. Where we talk about the people who were God's favorites, or those who thought they were. Thank you so much to everybody who donates to our Patreon. I use that money to buy research materials, get past paywalls, pay for streaming software, streaming service cost, and music. Running a podcast is actually slightly more expensive than you probably expected it to be. Tomorrow is April 1st, which means that it's Titanic Month over on my TikTok channel. I'm at Melissa Fairlady. We do Titanic Month all month long, and it's going to be pretty fun, I think. So if you want to join along with the fun, again, it's at Melissa Fairlady. Sources for today's podcast include Napoleon Alive by Andrew Roberts, Napoleon.org, Britannica.org, Toussaint Louverture, a book by Philippe Girard. And there is so much more to come in this story. We're still not even close, man. This is probably going to be the longest series I've ever done, but I'm okay with it. It's pretty interesting.
Join us for the next episode when we meet Catherine the Great's grandson, who is just as petty, if not pettier, than she is. Is pettier a word? I don't know. We're marching toward the end of an empire, and it only takes about a decade. That's the crazy thing. Like, he just drove it right in the ground. This is a fun series, and I'm always looking for more people to cover, and if I don't even know the story, I'll learn it. So if you have an idea for a topic, you can email me at melissafairlady@gmail.com and send some suggestions or message me on social media. And, as always, see you next time, friends.